Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Indeed, on Dear Science today, Marcus and I spoke about Vikings and supercomputers. But to begin with, we started talking about the Ig Nobel Awards this year. And I started by asking him exactly what those awards were.
So everyone's heard of the Nobel Prizes. They are, you know, celebrating the highest levels of achievement in their respective fields. The Ig Nobel Prizes are at the other end of the scale. They don't celebrate failure, but they do celebrate sort of quirky, comical discoveries that are maybe a little bit eye-catching or make you think, why on earth did they do that? And these have been going on for, this is the 30th year now, and there were several Nobel laureates awarding the prizes to the Ig Nobel laureates. And the prizes that were awarded, the winners received a fake $10 trillion Zimbabwean bill, and they were emailed a 6-page PDF to print and assemble into a cube-shaped trophy.
Right. So yeah, it is. It's all quite crazy. But I guess to give people an idea of what kind of research we're talking about here, what were some of the examples of the winners this year?
Okay. So they don't have standard fields like the Nobel Prizes, but they had several prizes this year. The prize in entomology went to an investigation of why many insect researchers are themselves fearful of spiders. And this was a survey of, you'd think if you're going to study them, you wouldn't be afraid of them. But this was a survey of arachnophobic entomologists. I love that phrase. Published in 2013 in American Entomologist, which is obviously a journal. And they explored why people who devoted their careers to critters such as cockroaches and maggots still found spiders unnerving. And the most disliked traits were their fast, unpredictable movements and, maybe non-surprisingly, their many legs. Another example, the Acoustics Prize. This went to researchers who recreated, in reptiles, the party trick of inhaling helium from balloons. And this was, see, all of these, they sound weird, but they do actually have a basis, usually, in scientific inquiry, and they are valid, but they just sound crazy. So these scientists were studying crocodilian vocalizations, and you know, they wanted to find out how reptiles produce sound from vibrations in their vocal tract. And so they placed the alligators in an airtight helium-filled chamber and found that some of the high energy frequency bands of their bellows got even higher. So basically the alligators started sounding squeaky. This one I think is great. The prize in psychology went to a couple of researchers who discovered that distinctive eyebrows are perceived as a cue of grandiose narcissism. In other words, you can judge whether a person suffers or exhibits narcissistic behavior by looking at their eyebrows.
Wow, so that's actually quite helpful, possibly, though.
It could be, yeah. So apparently if you've got thick and dense eyebrows, you're more likely to be a narcissist, or at least you're more likely to be judged to be a narcissist.
So keep them nicely pruned,
keep them trimmed. Keep your eyebrows trimmed, yeah. Just a couple more, the last one. The finding that knives cannot be crafted from frozen human feces, despite a previous account of an Inuit man doing just that.
All right, so that one was a bit of a myth buster.
So don't eat poo to eat food, in other words.
Yeah. I didn't even think about for using it as cutlery sort of knife. I was thinking you were going to stab someone with your feces.
Either way, don't do it.
All right, well, maybe we should bring the tone down a little bit and get a bit serious with some of these other stories here. But still very interesting. We've got the research that's been going on around Vikings.
This is sort of a long-term study on looking at the DNA from Viking remains buried across Europe, into Greenland, and even into America. I don't know about you, but I've been watching some of the Viking shows on Netflix and other places, and you know, it's I think they're great, and I find it interesting. But it doesn't ever really distinguish between Vikings from different parts of Scandinavia, from Norway and Sweden or Denmark, and what made you a Viking, and you know, where did the Vikings sort of end up? But it seems like some of these data from sequencing DNA of Vikings across Europe, the big story, I guess, you know, who were the Vikings, where did they come from, where did they go, was in line with what's told by archaeologists and historians already, but some of the small details are actually really quite compelling. So one example is that Vikings were not necessarily all from the same country. You weren't a hereditary Viking. You could be co-opted into being a Viking. So there was evidence of Vikings or people being given Viking burials in England and in other parts of Europe, who were genetically not related to people from Scandinavia. So the evidence that they were being co-opted into this Viking way of life.
Right, and so for that reason, there are some also misconceptions about what Vikings even look like, right, which this study has
uncovered. And so Vikings, it turned out, were more likely to have black hair than people living in Scandinavia today. And this may be related to the fact that the Viking was really a job description, not a matter of hereditary. And another interesting thing I found in the article was that Vikings from different parts of Scandinavia tended to go to different parts of Europe. So Vikings from what is now Sweden tended to move east to the Baltics, to Poland, into Russia and Ukraine. The Danes were more likely to head west to what is now England, and the Norwegians were the ones who sailed across the North Atlantic. They colonized Ireland and Iceland and eventually Greenland, and beyond that, even the United States. And some mystery still remains. So Viking settlements in the Americas haven't yet yielded bones that are candidates for sequencing. So the identity of the first European settlers in the Americas is still a mystery, because obviously it was the Vikings who went to America long, long before the Europeans in the 15th and 16th centuries. But exactly where those Vikings came from is still a bit of a mystery.
Right. So as Alan often says, more research it might be needed.
More research, absolutely. Mm. Yeah.
All right. Well, then lastly here, we've got IBM's planned 1,000-qubit quantum computer. Now, I think to begin with, it would be nice to know what exactly is a quantum computer and what is a qubit?
So they're pronounced qubit.
Oh, well, there you go.
So we all carry computers, you know, in our bags and our pockets and we have them in our houses. And they contain silicon chips which have billions and billions of transistors, which are little bits of silicon that are imprinted onto the chip. And each little transistor is essentially just a switch. So a bit in terms of computing is basically either an on or off switch. So our computers have, you know, trillions of bits in them. They have trillions of little switches that either switch on or off, and they control what the computer does. Now, quantum computers are a little bit different. They are made instead of bits, they are made of quantum bits or qubits. And these are usually little bits of material. So IBM are using little metal particles that are cooled down very, very cold temperatures. And they offer the possibility of vastly increasing the power of computing, because they follow different rules. They don't follow just the regular on-off rules of the transistors that we use in our machines today. They follow these quantum rules that, instead of being just on or off or one or zero in bit language, these quantum bits can be set to one or zero, or because of the strange sort of weird quantum mechanics rules, they can be one and zero at the same time. And this fact means that you can develop computers from these quantum bits that are many orders of magnitude more powerful. The problem is these quantum bits are very, very, very delicate. So it's very, very difficult to build a quantum computer, because you have to store these individual bits, usually at very low temperatures, close to absolute zero. And these devices are gigantic compared to the transistors you have in your computers.
Yeah, so IBM is building a massive refrigerator to keep them all cold.
Exactly, that's essentially what it is. And so currently, IBM have a machine And I'm not sure if this is the largest quantum computer in the world, but it's probably close to that. It has just 65 qubits. And they've just announced that by 2023, they hope to have built a quantum computer containing 1,000 qubits. Now, 1,000 or even 65 or 1,000 is nothing, absolutely nothing, compared to the number of bits in your phone, in your pocket, or in your computer on your desk. But these are potentially machines that could solve some really important problems that are sort of intractable for regular computers. And a lot of these involve cryptography, you know, breaking cryptographic systems and solving mathematical problems that a regular computer just can't do. Not that it's slow, it just can't. They are planning to build intermediate machines with 127 and 433 qubits in the next couple of years. And they envision, ultimately, a machine with 1 million qubits in the future, in the near future, hopefully, but they haven't specified a date.
Kia ora, Motet, and kia ora, Marcus. We'll be right back after this.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
A lot of